that bolt would eventually wear a egg-shaped hole due to stress concentration. I am guessing you handled that by a combination of a smooth bolt, only threads at the tail end, and I'm guessing that your mast was something like Schedule 40 steel pipe as opposed to aluminum. You would get away with it. It was fairly thick-walled aluminum. But thin-walled aluminum, I think you would have worn an egg-shaped hole, and if the threads were pressing against the aluminum, then it would really wear an egg-shaped hole pretty fast. Was it a steel mast that you used, Mel? Go ahead.
Oh, yeah, Roger. Yeah, that's all steel. That mast, the upper mast weight, quite a bit. The upper mast weight, I would fetch over about 150 pounds of heavy wall steel mast, 2 inches in diameter. It then sits on the bearings, the two bearings in the tower, the top bushing, the tower bronze bushing. Then sits on the bearings right below it, about 2 feet below it. Now, that's then there's a coupling point. That's where the coupling takes place. There's a piece of pipe that has actually called a gimbal coupling. So in other words, a slight misalignment between the rotor and the top mast is corrected by this so-called pivot in there. It's a pin, heavy pin there. And that pipe is very close to just fits in there, you know, not tight, but snug enough. And then that's pinned in the rotor. So it's all steel pipe. You couldn't rush that pipe, any of that pipe. I don't think you could, with anything, you could pull up on a wrench with a bolt nut, no matter how hard it is, put any kind of a crush on that piece of pipe that I'm using. Of course, like I say, if you drill that hole is so precise, there isn't any movement. In other words, if there's any slight movement, I can just, like Dick said, it's going to eggshell itself out. But if there is no movement to begin with, everything is tightened down. I've had it when I was up for a long, long time. Maybe at this location, it's up 30 years before. Never have it moved so far, I think, over.
How many feet of boom have you got on that Yagi? How many element Yagi? On what band is that, Bill? Probably more than one antenna, too.
Yeah, it's six elements. Six elements wide space on 36 feet.
What's the brand name of rotator that's rotating that?
The Ham M. The Ham, this one is the tail 2-2. The tail twister 2. The other one was the Ham M. Was the original Ham M. It was up there 25 years. And I'm looking at it in the garage. It's got to be taken apart. Something so it just stopped one day in one spot. It just jammed itself up somewhere. I don't know what to call it. What has happened inside of it? Never opened it up. Just went ahead and bought a new one, Dick. Figured, most likely be rebuilt. I can imagine with the amount of wear on it, the amount of time that's been turned back and forth over, 25, close to, it must be more, I think, 2 years. Yeah, 30 years easy. Dick, replaced in 2005 over.
And you live in a seaside community with a lot of wind, and the antenna wasn't wind balanced. Wow. And that's a lot of mass, a lot of boom to put on that poor little tail twister or ham end. I guarantee you've really worn those gears and they're something fierce. Wow. In fact, the brake mechanism, the V, you may have broken that brake mechanism. No. You're going to find quite a story in there. And if it was up there with all those years without the service every few years, the poor bearings, the ball bearings, have dug themselves into that race and made all kinds of indentations. The antenna itself, the six-element wide space 20-meter beam, sounds to me like that's about 100 pounds of antenna, maybe more, and that's 100 and some odd pound mast. How did you install that in the top of the tower, Mel? Go ahead.
Okay. The top section, I went up with the, jib type setup. Basically, I can raise up the rod section. You know, that's rig. You make up a rig like that. It was a homebrew version of it. They had it in one of the magazines. I remember, you welded the hook. You pull it up, the hook, the rung on the tower, and the bottom clamp's on, and there's a pulley operation, the pulley. See, there's another thing I also modified one of them. I got a special pulley that if you pull up on the pulley and let go the rope, it locks. You have to pull a secondary rope to let go of the primary rope that's doing the lifting. So, yeah, with a lot of weight to lift, but with the right system, right, you gotta, you know, study the situation that you have. And, I guess if Archimedes was right, he'd be the right lever, I could lift the world. So, I don't think, you know, putting this thing up is, you know, beyond an engineering feat. Getting great engineering feats, it's just a matter of, you know, doing things correctly and safely, take over.
Yeah, all of these things are calculatable. They're all deterministic. The amount of wind load, the amount of weight, the amount of twist due to the wind. When it comes to the foot-pounds of torque and pounds of antenna that you put on a ham amp or on a tail twister, I think in both cases you exceeded it by a whole lot. But you made it work. Why don't you go to the next guy in the mailbag? KQRIW.
This is KQI, very good. All right. And like I say, there's a number of other modifications on the rotor, but I won't go into that at this point, such as changing the bottom. There was also a number of people that told me about, you know, problems with those bottom quarter 20 screws that screw into the bottom plate, and, you know, the bottom plate of the casing, that sometimes they've been stripping them. And there's a way of really taking care of that too. Let me get that complaint from the gentleman. So we'll let that go. Because we'll go on with some other stuff here. Yeah. Alright, let me look. Oh, here's something. Here's something that was made in a week ago or more. The field on astronomy. Okay. You guys discuss astronomy very often. I enjoy listening to your comments on it. I got last year for Christmas a family observer binocular 7x50 with a field of 7.1 degrees. I enjoy sitting out sometimes and out in the backyard many a time looking up at the universe and amazed what I can see with these binoculars. However, when I go up and turn the house, all the street lights seem to block out whatever I can possibly see. Is there a type of binocular or something adds to binoculars? Are there some kind of a scope that are meant for situations like this? Will you assist?
That's a tough one. First of all, 7.1 degrees means, if I didn't do it correctly, it means 37 feet at 100 yards. I think that is not wide angle type. There are binoculars that are wide angle. I have to go look at mine and see what the number is on them. I should know, and I forgot. The so-called light pollution you get from the city light is a tough one. There are people who join an organization called the Dark Skies, where Dark Skies, I think it is an organization, where they try to convince Con Ed, LIPA, and other organizations to install lighting on highways which has a shield in the lighting, so the light only goes down and not up. Lighting that goes above 0 degrees elevation has two disadvantages. One, it creates glare in the eyes of the drivers on that road, which makes it more dangerous, increases the accident, and second of all, it creates a flare light in the sky. When you go to a truly rural area, like Cherry Springs Park in Pennsylvania, Cherry Springs, I don't know the full name now, Cherry Springs something park in northern central Pennsylvania. For all the surrounding towns, they make sure that the lighting is controlled and is considered one of the very darkest areas on the east coast of the United States. People could go there summer, winter, spring, and fall on the appropriate weekend or even during the week and look at what a truly dark sky is like, where you see the whole Milky Way and you say, that has been hidden from me all of these years. I have missed that. Wow. By the way, you've got to be out in the dark for more than 20 minutes to get fully dark adapted eyes. Scotopic vision versus photopic vision. And so the human eye readapts when it's really dark to chemistry of your retina changes, and you see the sky in a very different way. There are cameras and computer programs that you connect to a telescope for taking astrophotography. And you can, with careful use of the program, get some correction. In other words, you can teach the camera what the background lighting is like. You take the real picture, you teach it what the background lighting is like, and you have it do a subtraction program where it subtracts the background lighting from the picture you've taken, and it makes a significant improvement. So when it comes to a multi-step Photoshop-like process that you do with a modern-day charge-coupled device camera connected to a telescope or to binoculars, you can connect a camera to binoculars, you can get some correction. But with the human eye, is there a device you can put between your eye and the binocular?
Repeater.
Or put it in front of the binoculars to get the correction? To my knowledge, there is not. You can put fancy filters in front of the binoculars. One of the things that will be a lot of fun, and you wouldn't believe this until you do it, you buy the right kind of a adapter for your binoculars, and you go to the Northeast Astronomy Forum, NEAF, which is held every year in springtime at Rockland Community College. You go there into their main gymnasium and you will see 60 or more vendors of optical equipment, telescopes and whatever. And some of those guys sell very fancy structures that will screw onto your binoculars that allow you to adapt the binocular to a tripod. You wouldn't believe how much more visibility you have of sky or of terrestrial objects when the binoculars are being held steady by a tripod. Makes a huge difference in what you can see, because your hands are always shaking unless your hands are braced against a window and you're holding the binoculars in your hand and your hands are braced against a car or a window. Even then, it's not as steady as you can get with the tripod. So by making the stars and the other celestial objects not move, really sit steady in the binoculars, that makes them twice as bright, so to speak. So even with flare light of city environment, you will see more stars if the binoculars are held steady. But with the naked eye, the unaided eye connected to the binoculars, you sort of have to live with street lighting. They do have sky dome, or what you're going to call it now. They do sell domes that will create a direct blockage of the lighting from the street light that's across the street. You're going to be sitting in the shadow of the dome and looking up at the sky in your easy chair. That helps. Unfortunately, in the metro area, the majority of the light that you see is hitting the haze that's in the atmosphere and reflecting it back down into your telescope and into your binoculars. So the reflective haze that's in the atmosphere from all of the parking lots and stores, I mean, what's going on here is that people have been over-convinced that if they have extremely bright lighting everywhere, then it stops crime. There's not a great deal of confirming evidence of that. Yes, you shouldn't create a street and a store and a parking lot that is pitch black, but the lighting they put into them for crime control is extremely excessive, wastes a lot of power, wastes a lot of light bulbs that have to be replaced, and because the shades and the shades that are on those bulbs are not directing the light downward, allowing flare light to go out to the horizon and up above the horizon, is contributing to this problem. The serious astronomical people go to dark areas. Custer Institute in South Hold, Long Island, is one of the very darkest places you can find on Long Island. Delaware, Vermont, is another very dark area. Cherry Springs Park in Pennsylvania, an extremely dark area. And the Rockland Astronomy Group, have a couple of their favorite spots, I guess, in the Southern Catskills that are very dark. You wouldn't believe what the sky looks like when you really go to a dark area. Night and day. There's a pun there somewhere. KQKUY, KQRAW.
2KTY.
All right.
So in other words, there isn't any magical pair of binoculars that will essentially work in a heavy lighted area. Am I correct to sum it up, Dick?
That's correct. There are people who will create shades in their backyard, create barrier fences, or build one of these dome-like structures to at least get rid of the local street lighting, and maybe the light that's shining in the backyard from your neighbor, so that you can see straight up without the light coming into the binoculars or the telescope beside you. Every telescope, even though the inside of your binoculars or telescope are painted black, there's a degree of blackness that they're not. By that I mean a street light from across the street, hitting your binoculars' side view, reflects back and forth inside the barrel of the binoculars, and eventually ends up in the eyepiece. There are people who will buy extremely black velvet-like material that's sold in some of the optical vendors, and they will re-line the inside of their telescope or inside of their binoculars with this velvet-like material, which is a lot blacker than the black paint that's in there. That helps some. That combined with shading devices like a dome or build artificial fences, that helps. But these amounts of help are only going to give a 20% improvement in the program, in the problem. You want a 98% solution, you have to go to a dark area. You have to go to an area that does not have a lot of man-made lighting. It's obvious that early mankind didn't have anywhere near the amount of artificial light that we have in modern society. Therefore, those people out in the dark at nighttime, they saw the sky. And that's why they were so busy naming all those constellations and coming up with the astrology, so-called science. And the sky to them was something very significant. They saw it a lot. We never see it. You stand in Manhattan, in Central Park, and you look up at the sky, and you see a few of the bright stars. You go to a truly dark area, and you'll see 100,000 stars. Tremendous difference. In fact, you learn the sky in the metropolitan area. You learn where Orion is, and you learn where Sagittarius is, and you learn where the Big Dipper is, Ursa Major, Ursa Minor, and so on. You learn where all these constellations are in a metropolitan area. And you go to a truly dark area, there are so many stars in between those constellations you've never seen before, you will have great difficulty recognizing the location of this constellation that you have already learned what they look like and where they are. The sky is so busy, all of a sudden it seems like you've got to learn it all over again. You wouldn't believe it if you haven't been through the experience. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. I assume that it's not as simple as a simple shape. I can imagine being nice to be out in the country someplace where it's pitch dark at night. The only light you have is what basically comes from your own house. And you just shut them off and go outside with beautiful telescope and look at the universe. Of course, I've been many places where really the big sky is amazing what you see there. I mean, the sky really comes alive. It's phenomenal, just even with the naked eye. All right, want to try another one, Dick?
Sure do. By the way, I thought of the name of that. Cherry Springs State Park in Pennsylvania. Probably the darkest area on the eastern shore of the United States, Cherry Springs State Park. If you can arrange to have your family pass through that area and stop in there on a nice clear night, you wouldn't believe what you can see. Was there someone else who wanted to make a comment?
November 2, Oscar Alpha Mike.
November 2, Oscar Alpha Mike. Thought of your name, sir, and then your question or comment. My name is Dick.
Good evening, Dick. My name here is Bob. As far as the streetlight problem you were just talking about, can you tell me what the refractor on the streetlight looks like, glass piece underneath? kind of rounded and hanging down?
Can I tell you what it looks like? Okay, I think what you're asking is, on a well-designed streetlight that's recommended by the Dark Skies Society, there are very specific brand names and model numbers of streetlights that they recommend be either installed on new installations, or if you can get your town to be sufficiently enthusiastic, to remove the ones they got and add them. So there are some definitely recommended higher efficiency, better designed shades for streetlights. But a heck of a lot of the streetlights, when you're driving your car and you're quite far from the streetlight and you're looking into the streetlight at a nearly parallel angle to the ground, nearly purely horizontal angle, you should not be able to see the streetlight. You should see the light that it is creating on the road in front of you, but you should not be able to see the streetlight if it's properly designed. Whatever that streetlight is doing is creating glare in your eyes, which is increasing the chances of you having an accident. There's a whole lot of reasons for changing the design of a lot of the streetlights. I think that's what you're asking, Bob, but I'm not sure. Back to you, Bob.
Hey, Dick. What I really wanted to know was if Mel knew what the glass on the streetlight looked like. Because there's been a model out, it's been out for quite a while now. They're called FCO, the full cutoff. They have, you know, the typical streetlight, the Cobra head style streetlight that they used for the awards probably in the 1970s. The glass refractors are usually round and they hang down below the body of the lamp. That's been the typical refractor for practically forever. Those type of refractors will put light out above the horizon. The full cutoff ones don't use that. And you see them on a lot of the parkways in and around Long Island. When you look up at them, the bottom of the streetlight is flat. There is a piece of, you know, flat piece of glass where that rounded piece is through. And that will put all of the light below the horizon. Now, you're still, of course, going to get reflections from cars and roadway and whatnot. But that, you know, a streetlight like that might help in this situation.
It certainly would. It would help a lot. And a tremendous amount of the street lighting and other kinds of safety lighting and crime avoidance lighting that we have really needs redesign or reinstallation. It wasn't done correctly by modern standards. There are progressive communities in the United States who have elected to do something about this. It improves the beauty of the neighborhood. When you look at a neighborhood that is properly lighted without flare light directly from the street light coming into your eyes, the contrast of what you're looking at improves, the color rendition improves, and particularly if it's a full-spectrum light, the community can look a lot prettier. It's as good as, you know, painting town hall, if you know what I mean. Painting all the buildings in the town hall area. It can make things look a hell of a lot nicer and be a lot friendlier for people who are astronomy-oriented, as to some degree we should be. Astronomy is probably one of the oldest and most pure sciences there is. It has some very deep questions that are going to take a long time to answer. But it expands the minds of people. Good stuff. Great things to teach children. It's a great hobby. You look through a really well-designed, let me drop, modern-day telescope, and you put the right kind of a filter in front of it, a Bader filter, for instance. B-A-A-D-E-R is the name of the company that makes a very good film that you mount into a cardboard frame that you make that puts on the front of the scope or puts on the front of your binoculars, and you look with a good tripod into the sun. You wouldn't believe what you're going to see, how elaborate that object can be at certain times of the day and year, the sunspot cycle. The fires around the perimeter, the sunspots in the middle, the so-called snakes, you know, you're looking at the result of a very strong magnetic field on the sun. It's really a great big ball of gas, is what the sun really is. A boiling ball of gas, continuously changing and boiling. That's a fun thing to look at. When you have the right kind of a inverting eyepiece so that the telescope doesn't give an upside-down image, there's a lot of fun things to look at that are terrestrial. You don't have to go to Grand Canyon with a telescope to see something pretty. Just look at the buildings in New York City. Look at the birds in the trees or the squirrel that's on your property. Look at the crow that's in your tree. I mean, with the right kind of a telescope, you get a very bright image as if you were a couple of feet away from that animal, even though you're 150 feet away from them. I periodically set up my telescope in my driveway, look up at my tower, which is 70 feet away in the backyard, and look up at the hardware on the tower. With the right eyepiece on my 8-inch diameter telescope, from 150 or 200 feet away, I can make a single quarter 20 bolt that's 2 inches long fill up the whole field of view. I can inspect the tower 2 inches at a time. I can find out what bolt is rusty, what bolt is loose, what cable is not being properly connected, what needs repair, what weatherproofing. In other words, I can figure out exactly what tools I should put into my pocket or into my tool bag before I climb the tower. That at times is very handy. And one day that got me into a little bit of trouble. I'm using a binocular, set of binoculars on a tripod, looking at the tower, deciding what I'm going to repair next, and I saw these two objects behind the tower. Soon found out that these were what I believe were UFOs. Two hamburger-shaped metallic objects that I could see through the binoculars but could not see with the naked eye because these were gray-colored objects identical to the grayness of the sky that day. They had zero contrast. Under normal circumstances, because of their distance, smallness, and grayness, with zero contrast, you would not have seen them. But from my point of view, they were against a white cloud, and I'm seeing them. I call my son, who at the time, I think he was around 20 years old, with a good set of eyes. I said, "Hey, tell me what you see." To which he said, "Holy blank." I won't fill in that word. You can make some guesses. Then he called out his mother. And the three of us were passing the binoculars back and forth, and we watched these two objects sitting absolutely stationless in the sky for 20 solid minutes. Very difficult to explain what we were looking at. Very distinct objects when they were against the white sky. Did the object disappear? No. The cloud eventually moved, the contrast went to zero, and we lost sight of them. So, using binoculars to inspect your tower to figure out what you're going to repair next can create other little sagas in your life, and it did in my case. K2KY, oh, do you have any further questions or comments on this one, Bob, before we turn it back to Mel? And to OAM, K2RIW, my name is Dick.
So, Dick, that should just about cover it. Just thought I'd throw that in there. But I'm too off the off the mark.
Okay, Mel, you got it. You go to the next one if you want to.
One final comment. Did you know that the NASA is going to reopen the investigation about that something that crashed in Pennsylvania some years ago, and that the question is really what crashed there? They said it was, a lot of people said it was a cover-up because there was claims that from some witnesses that a very large 18-wheel flatbed truck brought into the area after that, and something was loaded onto the truck and covered over and taken away. They said that was a cover-up, that what really crashed was a military aircraft with some secret equipment on, or a lot of people said they just saw a disc floating across the horizon and an impact. Did you ever hear of that situation, Dick, over?
That particular situation, I think I have not heard about, Mel. I'm quite sure how many years ago it took place. But the fact they had a truck ready to pick it up fairly soon, I am guessing, suggests that it was a man-made object and a classified test. Could have been. The fact that the truck was there, ready to roll, to pick up the pieces, so to speak. I mean, if you truly had a UFO incident in the middle of Pennsylvania, and it was thoroughly unplanned, it would take you an awful long time to assemble the people to cordon off the area, to find the right piece of hardware, to pick up the object, put it on a flatbed, and take it away. That would take days, in my opinion. There isn't a standby crew that I know of ready to pick up any UFO that happens to drop into rural Pennsylvania, if it was a rural area. So I think the probability is high that it was a American-made product under a test. Whereas in my particular case, this occurred at 3 o'clock in the afternoon in August on a Sunday afternoon. You could say at high noon, but it was 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Not easy to explain how something can sit absolutely motionless. And I could tell it was motionless because I could see the relationship between the two objects and the tower, which was 70 or 80 feet away from me. It was 100 feet away from me at the time. So I could move my head back and forth and see the parallax and realize that these objects didn't move with reference to my tower a fraction of an inch when viewed from 100 foot away, 150 foot away. You couldn't get a pair of helicopters for 20,000 minutes to have that kind of station keeping a pair of objects. So it's difficult to explain. Back to you, Mel, and you can go to the next one if you like. KQLIW.
Take just some final words on it. Well, the thing came down in Pennsylvania, it came down on somebody's farm. And I understand that the farmer, whoever it was, called some government agency. It called something. He was like trying to keep it somewhat of a secret that he wanted to see what he could get out of the situation monetarily. And then when the word got out about something, I don't know how it slipped out, I guess he was thinking he was, you know, boasting about what he has or whatever. At that point, the government or whoever was in charge, you know, whatever they do, getting, you know, picking up the arrived, but it wasn't the same day at the same time. It was some days later, and the few witnesses were able to get a quick glimpse that they loaded something on a truck, covered it over, and took it away, and subsequently, this guy was a farmer, he moved someplace, you know, just in other words, he sold out, sort of disappeared the way Dick this is the story. I mean, it was just a thing that they stuck on, you know, on when I brought up my web. They would have a bunch of things pulled, but that was supposed to be going to reopen the whole thing and see what exactly this is all about. That should be the near future.
Yeah, how did you find out about this one, Mel?
As I bring up my regular web, AOL, they got a whole bunch of things always about, you know, news and all, and I'm looking down there, you know, they got all kinds of stories and all. One of the things is that they're asked to investigate UFOs from 1990 or something like that, Dick. So, you know, seeing that, I was interested, so I highlighted it, and there was a whole story about Shorty's newspaper article or whatever over.
Okay, sounds like fun. Back to you.
Okay, all right. All right, next thing. Let's see. There's no more time here. We'll try a couple more things here before you use the repeater. What is it? Let's see. Oh, I bought some parts. There's a company that makes parts for putting quads together. And they sold me the necessary parts to suspend the quad elements and all. However, they cautioned me that if I use insulated wire, they suggest buying this pre-worked copper. Oh, yeah, I know what you're talking about. This, you know, pencil-like copper wire that's supposed to be, you know, that's stretched out or whatever it is. Right? That's why they use. They suggest buying all of that. However, they said if you decide to use regular insulated wire, it will have a deep tuning effect on the quad. The quad, by the way, is for 10 feet or something. I don't know if really it's a is that really going to detune the quad insulated wire takeover?
To a small degree, the answer is yes. The so-called quad Yagi arrays that were popular, quad antennas that were popular 20, 25 years ago, most Americans built them with, I think it was 14-gauge house wire to make the square loop for the actual driven element and the reflector, maybe the first director. But they used a particular kind of 14-gauge wire with rubber covering in the United States. And the antennas were all very reproducible. The antenna became quite popular, and the Europeans, particularly the Germans, started making the antenna, and they realized that it was always tuned. I'm not sure if it was tuned high or tuned low, but it was all frequency. And the net result was the kind of rubber that's on the wire. The wire is a slightly different thing. There's a number of millimeters in Germany, not the fractions of an inch. They got a different wire gauge than us, and they have a different thickness of rubber covering. And the antenna was significantly wrong in standing wave ratio of the best frequency because of that. So they had to readjust the length of the loop accordingly. So on certain kinds of antenna, the rubber insulation does make enough of a difference that a serious moonbast operator considers it significant. So I think the difference is small, but it's not zero. Kind of hard to believe. Because a number of wavelengths, the wire is extremely thin, particularly when it comes to HF quad. I think on an HF quad, the effect is near zero. On a 432 megacycle quad, made out of 14-gauge wire, the thickness of the rubber insulation is, I think it's significant enough to shift the frequency of the antenna a few megacycles. If you try to turn it to 432 and it ends up at 435, you might not be happy. It may create, I'm going to pick a number, a 1.7 Vizwar, and you would like it to be a 1.2. So on 432, it can make a difference. On 20 meters, I doubt it. I doubt it very highly. By the way, the kind of copper you're talking about that they recommend is called hard-drawn copper. There's ways of treating copper to make it much more stiff, so it doesn't wave in the wind as much, therefore it doesn't rapidly build up metal fatigue and fall apart. Don't know where, but there is a source of hard-drawn copper wire somewhere. K2KE1, K2RIW.
Right, I know there's a number of places that sell dipoles, like RF font or whatever, the heck they call themselves. They sell that hard-drawn copper for antennas or transit stuff. And they advertise it as avoid catastrophic failure. All right, very good. Now, let's see. Oh, yeah, that's fantastic. A length of insulated conductor wire in an antenna, just to expand a little bit more, will have resistance, will have inductance, and what is the variable? In other words, the insulation is the in other words, we'll have the capacitance, would that be faster that we have to put in over?
Yeah, this is somewhat similar to a question I've had a few times asked to me recently. If you look at the good references, reference data for radio engineers, among others, you can figure out what impedance is your microstrip. Microstrip is a ground plane, usually made out of copper, on one side of printed circuit board, G10 or FR4 board. You've got one side is all copper, and the other side you've got a conductor of a given width, and the board itself is a given thickness. Depending on the thickness of the board and the width of your conductor on top, you are creating a transmission line, microstrip transmission line, and you could easily make it anywhere from 5 ohms to probably 90 ohms of impedance by adjusting that thickness and width. By the same token, you can take a round conductor in air that is lying parallel to a sheet of metal. It is a piece of microstrip. The dielectric just happens to be air. As you take that piece of wire and raise it higher and higher above that sheet of metal, you're making a transmission line of higher and higher impedance. It isn't too difficult to take that formula and figure out what would happen if I bring the wire to infinity, further and further away? You get a certain impedance of that wire. So, wire, some number of inches, feet, or miles above ground, has a certain characteristic impedance as a transmission line. And when we construct our dipoles and long wire antennas, to a certain degree, you could do the calculation with that in mind. Another simple rule that has often been used is that for conventional wiring in, say, for instance, a piece of electronics, ordinary 18-gauge wire has an inductance of 22 nanohenries per inch. 1 inch of 18-gauge wire at a reasonable distance above a ground plane in the wiring of your circuit will have 22 nanohenries per inch. I've often used that and come out extremely close. Half inch is going to be 11 nanohenries. 2 inches is going to be 44 nanohenries. 22 nanohenries per inch, 18-gauge wire. If you use thicker wire, the inductance per inch comes down a little bit. Coat it with rubber, and the impedance, the impedance becomes a little bit lower, and therefore the nanohenries per inch decrease a little bit. Maybe this is close to what you were asking. I'm not quite sure about. K2KE1, KQLIW.
Okay, so in other words, if we took the insulation off, the insulation is missing, the units of capacity would be increased by the amount of a dielectric, I guess. In other words, you will see by just taking the insulation off, how am I putting this the right word? By a small amount, the capacity will change from the bare wire. Am I correct? Over.
Yes. Coaxial cable transmission line. There's a formula for 176 times the log of A over B. Those are the ratio of the diameters, outer diameter and inner diameter. Times, all of it times 1 over the square root of the dielectric constant of the material. So, in general, a coax cable, take the square root of your material. For instance, if you had material with a dielectric of 4, it would lower, the square root of 4 is 2, it would lower the characteristic impedance by a 2 to 1 ratio. If you just consider the diameters of air type coax, fill it up with dielectric material of 4, and you've got exactly 1/2. If with air you had 70 ohm coax, put in a dielectric constant of 4, and you have 35 ohm coax. That's one way of looking at coax impedance. Another way of looking at it is coax impedance is proportional to 1 over the square root of mu over epsilon. Mu is the inductance per inch or per meter. Epsilon is the capacitance per meter. If you can calculate with the materials you're using, what's the inductance per meter and the capacitance per meter, to divide one into the other and take the square root, that tells you the proportion of the characteristic impedance. I think there's a constant out in front of 4 pi, but I'm not positive of that. So, coax cable does have a given, once you know the impedance of the cable, you can calculate almost exactly what is the inductance per inch and the capacitance per inch. I think ordinary 50 ohm coax, I think it's something like 27 picofarads per inch of coax. And I forget how many nanohenries per inch, but it's also easily calculatable. You could say you're using these distributed inductors and capacitors when you make yourself a stub tuner, a certain length of coax into a short circuit or into an open circuit, and you connect it to your transmission line with a T, you're creating an extremely, let me drop, you're constructing an extremely high Q inductor or capacitor, which has very low loss and can easily tolerate transmitting power levels. So by way of you locating the T connector on your transmission line in the right spot, you know exactly where you've created a point source capacitor or a point source inductor that is transmitting rated. Stubs are magic. And you could analyze a stub by saying it has a certain number of nanohenries per inch and a certain number of picofarads per inch. But using the Smith chart and the length of known G0 cable is, in my opinion, an easier way. It's only a scissor that'll take the first way that I just mentioned. Back to you, Mel. KQRIW.
Yeah. Exactly. Just when I put that receiving loop together, I was able to do the calculation to decide that I would require what I require in the tuning system basically measuring a foot of coax cable that I would use. That's, of course, on the outside periphery of the loop as to the, as like you said, the capacity per foot, which is 27 PM. And I did go through the whole routine of figuring out the induction loop and everything. That all had to be taken into consideration in making that type of receiving loop.
Okay.
So, all right, that sounds like a pretty good answer to all the questions. Have time for one more, maybe? Over.
Yes, we do. Go for it.
Here's a question. You guys did a very interesting tutelage on filter design. Roger. On Chebyshev filters and all. Yeah, I remember when we did this. I looked it up, I read it, and I would like to do some work. Very fascinated me with the making your own filters. Make yourself a CW filter. Okay, very good. However, you only touched upon, you said that you have to take into consideration when making this the crystals that you're using, and you have to determine factors about the crystals. Right. So could you tell me basically how did you really make this device to determine especially the frequency, the Q, and etc. on the crystal? Okay. Remember that now. What the heck did I do? Oh, I remember. There was an article that I was able to use because I was somewhat friends with a fellow by the name of Doug from 1FC. He writes, was a regular writer for USC years ago. And he had a very interesting little gadget that he made up at one time. Not so much for putting together filters, but just the general working with a lot of surplus crystals and all these guests and to be able to see if they would fit your circuit. And he had an article written in QST, I think it may be around 1990. I'm sure, but I'll tell you the name of the article. It was called the Test for Crystals F, Q, and R. Test for Crystals F, Q, and R by Doug Seymour, W1FC, and it'll be most likely back around late 80s or early 90s. I'm sure it was around 1990. And with that, you can go ahead and get an idea. You've got to get back your crystal if they can fit in the situation that you need. I did outline a number of other ways of going about designing Chebyshev filters and how to get a good flat response on the filter. Maybe do you recall anything more about it, Dick? Over.
Yeah, you were basically building a Q measurer. What are they called now? RLC measurer is what you were really building. A crystal, depending on which one of its two main resonant frequencies, fundamental resonant frequencies you're using, can be simulated by a series LC circuit or a parallel LC circuit. But in either case, you're trying to determine how big is the inductor, how big is the capacitor, and I said LC circuit, it's really an RLC, and how big is the resistor. If it's a series circuit, it's a series of L, R, and C. In other words, an inductor, a capacitor, and a resistor, all in series, is one of the equivalent circuits of a quartz crystal. Another equivalent circuit is a inductor, capacitor, and resistor, all in parallel with each other. And if you go one step further, the complete circuit of the crystal, because you've got some stray capacitance of the mounting leads and whatever, I think there's one other inductor thrown in there in some place. So by building yourself the right kind of a test fixture, which is really a kind of RLC measurer, or what do they call it now, a Q-bridge, there's a commercial product made by Hewlett-Packard, among other companies, that allow you to do this. So you built a fixture, and it's not too elaborate, the fixture. And in theory, it could be done with a signal generator. Maybe you could do a mediocre job by using a grid dip oscillator into this test fixture. So you have to measure the parameters of your particular available crystals. And then I think after you made a measurement of a whole lot of crystals, it is my guess, Mel, that you formed a married set of five or so crystals that set your particular requirements. Then when you assemble them correctly, out comes a beautiful filter. But you can't just pick up any old crystal and throw it in there. If you're willing to pay enough money, you can go to a factory that builds crystals and tell them exactly what you want for each one of them. And if I know correctly, if I'm guessing correctly, Mel, I think all of your crystals when you selected them are not identical. In other words, you want certain high-Q crystals in the middle of the filter and slightly lower-Q crystal filters on the input end and the outer end. Most well-designed filters have heavily loaded elements in the beginning and the end of the filter, and very lightly loaded elements with very high Q in the center. One way of looking at a well-designed multi-element filter is it sort of impedance matches itself to a very high impedance in the middle of the filter, which is a very high Q resonator, and then it tapers itself back down to the output connector. It's sort of like what's going on inside of a filter. The majority of the action takes place in the middle element. I'm now using some very high power transmitting bandpass filters, and I'm putting a whole lot of RF through them in a test that I've been running lately. And I noticed that I'm using a filter that's got 10 poles to it, 10 resonators. The middle two resonators are the ones that get hot. The rest of them stay ice cold. All the action takes place in the center. I wonder if your Chebyshev crystal lattice filter behaves in anything like that, Mel. K2KEY, K2LAW.
Oh, yeah, Roger. Well, okay, but on beginning with the crystals. Yes, I went through a heck of a lot of crystals. Oh, boy. I had at one point I had 200 crystals, 3.579 crystals. But they were purchased very little, for very little money. I think they were basically, you know, a common crystal that was used in everything from TV, VCRs, etc., you know. So you could get them at one point. They were selling digitally. I got them from, I think it was about $25. Remember, I found 100. I think it was, $12, I think, 100 at the time. So I went through them, and a lot of them were junk. And there was some mediocre, but what I finally did is I sorted out the ones, and I found that the ones that were excellent which had a Q, especially over 500,000. That's very important fact, that good high Q, 500,000 or better. And I also found that I then, what I did is once I got these crystals that were somewhere around that high Q of about 500,000, I measured the C. And I found that I was able to sort them out. And I was able to find that quite a number of them I could find with one PF. And I put them together. So I basically tried to use all the crystals as close to one another as possible. I thought maybe that would eliminate some of my problems there. So this is what I wound up doing basically with the crystals. Frequency, then the U, and finally I measured to see if the crystals there, so that I had crystals that would have had a Q of over 500,000, a C of about 1 PM. So it wound up making, I think, life a little easier. You see, I guess, you know, calculate filters. There's a lot of trickery involved. It's not a simple thing, I can say, to throw things together. You got to take in a lot of consideration when you're putting together. You know, if you're going to use bugging, try to get bugging crystals. You got to then figure in the holder, the Q and the parallel holder capacitance. know, it all comes into figures. What I even went through with the final casing, it was amazing that with the final casing, I remember, I put together the filter, which was a 14 pole. I wound up building a 14 pole .1 cc Chebyshev filter repeater.
Time out. Cancel. Good evening. Welcome to the W2EL repeater.
We missed a little bit of that FML. We missed a little bit of that because the machine timed out, but we're talking about the case capacitance was one of the variables on, I think you said 13 elements, 0.1 dB Chebyshev filter. And there are various kinds of designs of filters. Some of them, I guess, have almost the same resonator everywhere with variable coupling coefficients, and some of them have higher Q and lower Q elements in certain positions. When you finally built that filter, what was the center frequency? What was the bandwidth? Did the filter sound nice and clean? Did it have any ring to it? I think it was a narrow band filter for an IF strip for a CW reception, if I know you, that you were building. And center frequency, Q, bandwidth. And by the way, you said you had 500,000 Q, half a million. Wow. At one time, I thought you could only achieve that with a carefully mounted crystal inside of a glass envelope where all the air has been evacuated out. I'm amazed that a 3.7545 crystal, the so-called chrominant subcarrier frequency for American television, I'm amazed that any of those filters go up to 500,000. Wow. And by the way, there are four definitions of Q, and one of the definitions is the center frequency divided by the 3 dB bandwidth when it's used as a very lightly loaded filter. And another definition is the voltage rise at resonance or the current rise at resonance, both using the series equivalent circuit. That resonant frequency is the current rise at resonance, would tell you the Q. If you use the parallel resonant frequency, the voltage rise at resonance from a constant current generator, and so on. My guess is, Mel, you've got to be very careful to get any accuracy when you're measuring your Q of half a million. That means that 3.5 meg, half a million, the thing was 7 hertz wide. Wow. 7 cycles wide, if I got that correctly, out of 3.5 megacycles. That's a careful measurement. You must have had to do that with a synthesized signal generator. K2KEY, how did you do all that? K2LAW.
Wasn't easy. I remember at that time I had the availability of a laboratory. Yes, Crystal, yes, you're 100% right. You hit right on the nail on the head, they said. These are sealed glass cases. And they were made up special. They threw them in there. They were HD6 type crystals. And they were thrown in there. This is what was used as, not in the TV VCRs, but they were used in a number of banking items like the commercial cameras and all. There was a whole pile. I mean, they were true. They had a whole series. I could say they extended everything from junk crystals right up to real good commercial crystals. And I was able to sort out and get enough of them out of them. I literally had over 100 some odd crystals, over 100, maybe 100, close to 150 that really had no use as far as I was concerned in what I was doing. The final filter was a 350 hertz wide, and had a sensor frequency, which I had to fit for that Collins receiver, was a sensor frequency that I on the top of my head now, was about 445 kilohertz, Dick. That was the sensor frequency. I know it's somewhere in the 4,000 kilohertz something. 4 something 3. I think it was 5, something like that. That was my sensor frequency with a 350 cycle wide filter, Dick, over.
So it's around 4 and a fraction megacycles, if I understand correctly. And when you listen to Morse code with that filter, what does it sound like, Mel?
That's the difference. Because I have one of these gadgets I bought, which was very costly, a DSP unit. And it synthesizes supposedly all kinds of filter readout read out on this thing. It's not a cheap item, but I just had to have it to see what goes on, you know, wiring it to the receiver, and made by time waves. And I wanted to see what it sounds like, and you know something, you take, for instance, column crystal filters or a filter like this, for my ears it's night and day, maybe you because we're dinosaurs, six, but I prefer these type of filters, whether it be Collins mechanical filter or this type of Chebyshev type filter, as a these base filters. So they're superior, I think, to these DSP filters, as far as I'm concerned. Over.
Now, give me a couple of words on that. I am guessing that the Mel Schneider made Collins-like crystal filter has a nice, round, smooth sound to it. Not too much ring, and you really hear those 350 hertz bandwidth Morse code tones through that thing. It probably sounds a little bit like high fidelity. By comparison, the digital signal processor is doing an analog to digital conversion on the input signal. It has to worry about whether or not there's wraparound, overload, underload, whatever. It's got some ratcheting noise. It does its processing in digits. Then it has to convert the digits back into an analog signal. And I bet it has a little bit of raspiness to it. I bet it has a little bit of a hard edge to it by comparison to the nice round tone sound that you heard. I'm probably using the wrong words, but am I close to the difference that you heard, Mel? Go ahead.
Exactly. No ring. Doesn't have that after, you know, that after resting, that ring, or whatever you want to call it. It's very, very smooth. And, it's amazing that the, even if you listen to a single sideband station through it, you can see how the, you know, it's just smooth sounding. I don't know. If you do it for a single sideband station, of course, so you get a slight thing. I guess about a half, I get about 0.5 dB dip on the, you know, dip on the corners of the signal. But if you're listening to a CW signal, it's just like I could say more lifelike, something like a high fidelity. Let's put it this way: if you had high fidelity in CW, I guess this would be as close to it as possible. Now, as far as, but of course, it takes, this is a nightmare, let me tell you something. It's a lot of fun to experiment, but if you have to do this, if you've got a job and you have to, on an interview said, oh, I designed filters, you better know what you're talking about, because this could be, I could see how somebody could lose their mind with this kind of work. It's very easy over.
Yeah, we did it as a labor of love. We did it as a science experiment. We wanted to see what could be done. You were pursuing excellence. You were worried about the details. You wanted it to work well. Now, digital signal processing, in theory, is capable of some very high performance. But that requires a large number of digits of conversion. And it's very similar to what happened to the solid-state receivers in the beginning. They didn't sound so good. We voted with our wallet, and eventually they got better. And DSP can also be done better if you're willing to make the investment. We're coming to the end of the rope, Mel. They're going to close us off pretty good. This was segment number 1,159. And I'm going to say 73 to everyone. I think we've made progress. And back to you for your closing comment. Oh, by the way, how big was that filter? K2, KUY, you got it.
Not very large. It was, tough to put into any of the old radios. Fit it in where you have a chassis, you have room and all, just flip it in there and put connectors on the end and all. Yeah, okay, we can talk about that because they also worked some experiments on Gaussian. type filters, 12 dB filters, and that's on and on. I think we've covered all this. Okay, good night all. Like I said, we'll try to keep up with the emails. Thank you very much for joining us. That's 73. Have a great week. This is KTKY. Any final words, Tim?
Yes, it was fun. Be kind to each other. See you guys later.